Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl with another episode of the Corner Office Podcast. Today's guest isn't technically a CEO, although he has been one in the past. He is now the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America. His name is Steven Mnuchin. We're going to play the full interview that I did with him at the end of February before a live audience out at the UCLA Burkle Center for International Relations at the University of California, Los Angeles. Let me say again, it was a live audience, so you are going to hear some of them hissing and booing, and you will hear some of them applauding the things that Secretary Mnuchin says. And here you go. My chat with him following a set of remarks that you will hear me refer to as we roll this tape. Here you go. So, first of all, thank you all for coming. I appreciate you taking the time on this afternoon. Mr. Secretary, thank you also for your time. Let me ask you a kind of a framing question here. There was a story I read in researching this talking about you being the finance chairman for the Trump campaign.
Yes.
And people were saying, Steve, why are you doing this? What? And you said, look, if this works out, nobody's going to ask me why I was doing this. So the question is, how's it working out for you?
No, actually, the question was slightly different, okay? And let me first say, I consider it a great honor to serve the country.
Yep.
So. I think we live in a democracy. We're lucky to live in this country. We're lucky to have differences of opinions. And for me, I was never involved really in politics. Some people spend their entire life in politics. I recognized that there were certain issues that were in this country, and that's why I participated in the campaign. So, that's why I'm here.
What was it about the president's approach to the American economy that made you say, I want to work for this guy? That's a good point.
No, I think they're going to get more tired than I am. So, you know, that's kind of bad chance. Oh, yeah, I'm dealing with students. I forgot. There's a lot of students. So
what was it about the president's economic agenda that made you say, I want to do this and work on this?
Look, I go back to the comment of, you know, the financial crisis impacted lots of people. I operated banks that went under during the financial crisis. I saw the impact of what went on and how important banks are to local communities and the economic issues, and I felt an obligation to try to do things that would help people and help the economy, and particularly the middle class. And I think we're very proud of these accomplishments.
So we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to the tax bill and all that in a minute. But I want to talk about the last section of your remarks here about the sanctions that you were in charge of and responsible for, specifically the North Korean sanctions that were announced on Friday,
yes.
The new round. Sanctions, as you know, take years and decades to play out. The question is, do you, and more particularly, the president, have the patience to let them play out with North Korea?
Well, I'm not going to comment on kind of what we're going to do going forward and what patience we have and what patience we don't have, but I don't agree with you on your premise.
So, that they take decades?
Yeah, I don't agree with
that. North Korea's been under sanction for decades, sir. Iran's been under sanction for decades. It is true.
Okay, well, let me give you the facts.
Sure.
Because this we can have a debate about.
Sure.
Okay. There's 500 sanctions on North Korea since 2005. Basically, half of them been done in the last year. We have more sanctions authority now than we've ever had before. So, for example, we have now powers that we can sanction anybody who's doing trade with North Korea. So I would, in all respect, that that these things take some time, but it is not decades, and we've seen evidence that they are already having an impact. But let me also make a comment. Our issue is not with the people of North Korea. So we want to be careful that we're not doing things. There are things that we could sanction that impact the people. What we're trying to do is cut down his ability to do ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons.
And you're satisfied that these sanctions you announced on Friday are tightening the noose?
Absolutely. So what we started with was illegal ship-to-ship transfers. These are very granular. We now have identified ships that are violating UN sanctions, and these ships will be prevented from doing this again. We've also put out Coast Guard advisories. We're working with the Navy. This is a full effort across the government.
As you know, Ivanka Trump was in South Korea.
Yes.
For the Olympic delegation. She also, as you know, briefed the South Korean president, President Moon, on these sanctions. Given that she's a family member of the president, without a permanent security clearance, do you think that was appropriate?
I absolutely think it was appropriate.
How so?
Again, she's an assistant to the president. She didn't travel as a family member. She traveled as assistant to the president. I briefed her. You're not aware of what security clearance is needed one way or another for these things. And again, I'm very comfortable with what she did representing the country on a very important issue, I might add.
Let me take it to the tax law.
Yes.
That you and the president and the Congress passed last year. The president signed it. It took effect on the 1st of January, as you know. During your confirmation hearings, you said whatever tax reform the Trump administration is going to work on will not add to the debt and the deficit.
It's true, and I stand behind that.
Sir, the tax bill that's in force now adds $1.5 trillion to the deficit.
No, that's not the case. The tax bill scored on a static basis adds $1.5 trillion. Let me just go through the numbers.
Yes, sir.
There's $500 billion difference between what's called baseline and policy. Those are things that were going to be extended anyway. That takes the number down to $1 trillion. We believe that with 90 basis points of growth, there'll be over $2 trillion.
Why don't you explain what 90 basis points means?
90 basis points of GDP. So GDP going from basically 2.1% to 3%. And for you math majors in the room, the break-even's about 35 basis points.
So in other words, 0.3% on growth.
That's correct.
Okay. The catch, of course, is, and as you know, you did have two quarters of 3% economic growth this past year, but year-over-year growth in the American economy was 2.3%.
That's right. That's
so,
why
so
we're
you're still far away
things.
From target, right?
Absolutely. That's why we're doing all these things. So these things have some impact, and all of our economic plans are about creating sustained economic growth.
Help me understand then with some specificity how you're going to do that. Because the numbers that were engineered by the White House and the Council of Economic Advisors that went into the tax plan were, we're going to get 3%, here's how, as opposed to, these are our policies, which is going to get us to 3%.
Well, you must seem to have a bias because you're using the words engineered. So you obviously think that it was the policies were created. Again, what I would say is we fundamentally believe that we will have economic growth. And again, 35 basis points is the break-even. And we're already seeing this. By the way, we're seeing companies give millions and millions of workers bonuses all as a result of this. And for people who are getting these $1,000 bonuses, these are not crumbs.
Absolutely not. And I'm not going to imply that at all. And I'll get to the bonuses in a minute. But I want to back up to this 3% economic growth.
Yes.
You said we believe we're going to get to 3%. And my question Correct. To you, sir, is how? Why do you believe that?
Again, we have all different types of models, whether it's the CEA or whether it's at Treasury. Kind of it's a result of the tax bill, which we think adds significantly to growth, regulations, and trade policies.
Even though Wall Street banks, private economists, nobody agrees you're going to get to 3%.
That's actually not the case. So you look at all the research, and all the research has been increased. May not be at 3%, but all the research has increased significantly.
To the issue of the bonuses and the wage increases, you said 4 million workers in this economy?
4.5 million.
4.5 million have gotten one-time bonuses, right?
Yes.
So this is a labor pool of 155 million people, sir.
Yeah, so are you, for those four and a half million workers...
So my question is...
In 1 month, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. 4.5 million workers have already seen this impact.
By some estimates, it's about two. These Americans for tax reform.
I understand you're doing the math.
No. So the American for tax reform, say, plus or minus, 86 companies have given wage increases. 250 companies have given one-time bonuses. And I guess the question is, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a one-time bonus or a consistent wage increase over the next couple of years?
We fundamentally believe that there will be wage increases going through the
Why
workers.
Do you believe that?
Again, I just went through why we believe it. It's a function of economic policy. It's a function of making a more competitive system that companies can invest. And again, there's research that 70% of the tax burden is borne by the workers. So this is all about making a more competitive U.S. system for jobs. Thank you. Why don't we do this? Why don't we take a couple more questions from you, and then why don't we open up for the audience, because I know they're anxious to ask things as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, sir. I was told I had a half an hour, so maybe we'll go a little while longer. Okay. Here's another question about the tax law. What is being done now is a huge amount of fiscal stimulus, that is to say, tax cut money going into the economy at a time when we're near full employment and the economy is growing, not as fast as any of us want, especially, I imagine, you and the president. What is that going to do in this economy?
Well, you know, a lot of people talk about full employment, but you have to look at the employment rate and you have to look at the participation rate. The participation rate is way too low. So one of the objectives is to bring workers back in to create jobs. A lot of people have given up because they can't find jobs. So we believe that there is more opportunity to create that. And you're correct. It is stimulus, but it'll be paid back.
How so?
Again, I just said, if you look at, 35 basis points of growth.
0.3% on the GDP.
Correct.
And that's going to do it.
That's absolutely right.
Even though no tax cut in history has paid for itself.
That.
Not the Reagan tax cuts, not the Kennedy tax cuts. No tax cuts have paid for themselves.
You obviously have an opinion that you're trying, and it's different than my opinion. No, you have an opinion. Okay.
As you put fiscal stimulus into the economy, you have at the same time the Federal Reserve with its new chairman, Jay Powell, who's going to the Hill this week to give his semiannual monetary policy testimony. He is trying, or will be in the coming year, trying to raise interest rates.
He's going to try to raise interest rates?
Well, I guess he's the chair of the Fed, so he can do what he wants.
Right. He can't do what he wants, but the Board of Governors decides, so it's not a question of trying or not. I would also just point out the forward interest rate curve expects that interest rates will rise. So the question is not whether interest rates rise or not, it's whether they rise more than the market expects.
And what's your gut? What's your sense? I mean, you studied this for a long time. You did fixed income.
Again, what I would say is I respect the independence of the Federal Reserve, so I'm not going to comment on my projections of interest rates. That's for the Fed.
Okay, fair enough. But as you and the president and the Congress with this tax law put fiscal stimulus into the economy, Chair Powell and the Board of Governors of the Fed are starting to worry about inflation and raising rates. Do you not see a conflict there between fiscal policy and monetary policy?
Actually, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I speak to Chair Powell and others on a regular basis. I don't think people are concerned yet about inflation. If there inflation shows up, that could be a concern. If anything, the Fed has wanted more inflation over the last 2 years. So a little bit of inflation is a good thing. As I've said before, wage inflation is something we want. Now, one of the good things right now is, we're close to energy independence. Very different thing than 10 or 20 years ago, where a big concern of inflation was energy prices. We have abundance of energy in the United States, and that's a very important issue on both a geopolitical and an economic basis.
Since you mentioned the global economy and our role in it with the energy markets, let me ask you about something you said about 10 days, 2 weeks ago, that after the president said at Davos, you know what, we might get into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Obama-negotiated deal that President Trump pulled us out of early in his administration. President said, you know, I might be able to get back into that if we could work out a way that's advantageous. And then you said the other day the president and his administration would be willing to go, and these are your words, go multilateral. That deal is going to be signed and done on the 8th of March or so. What interest do you think the other Trans-Pacific Partnership
I think they have a lot of interest. I've met with them a lot recently, and to the extent that they are absolutely willing to have discussions with the United States if that's something we want to pursue.
And you fully expect that they will let America back into the TPP?
Again, it's not a question of letting us back in or not letting us back
in.
Well,
the president pulled us out, sir.
Again, just to be clear, trade... has been a real issue for the United States. We have very serious trade deficits. The president believes in free trade. If you look at China, the U.S. market is open to China. The China market is not open to U.S. companies. That's why we have a very unfair trade deficit. So the president is trying to do things that are good for American workers and good for the American economy and create fair trade deals. That's what this is all about.
Are you expecting that the TPP 11, the countries left, will let America back in? Are they interested in having these conversations?
Again, what I would say is they're interested in us being in agreement. Right now, the president, okay, is more focused on bilateral trades, and that's our priority, and that's what we're negotiating. So I think we've talked about a bunch of these agreements. That's the priority. What the president has said is, kind of when we get done with the bilaterals that we're focused on, to the extent that kind of the TPP will change, we will consider, not a question of whether they will let us back in, we will consider whether we want to go into the multilateral agreement.
That sounds very much like, and I apologize for characterizing your words, but it sounds very much like you're saying, we will deign to have a conversation with them in which they might be allowed to trade with us.
That's not what I said. So, again, let's just be clear. The United States is the largest trading market in the world.
Absolutely.
Everybody wants to do business in the United States. The United States has the lowest tariffs, has the lowest barriers. Every single country wants to do business in the United States. And, by the way, to the extent that we can do business with other countries on the exact same terms, okay, and our companies can be treated the exact same way, we believe in reciprocal free trade. So that's our objective.
Let me ask you about a trilateral trade agreement. NAFTA negotiations, I suppose.
Yep.
As you know, I think the seventh round is going on this week. The president is, in his public stances, conflicted, apparently, about what NAFTA means to this economy.
Well,
what's your
why
sense?
Why is he conflicted?
Well, because at one point he's out, and at one point he's let's have negotiations. So what is your sense?
The president's been very clear all along. This is an old agreement, okay? The president wants to renegotiate this agreement.
I'm not saying it doesn't need to be updated, sir. My question is...
I'm answering your question.
Of course.
The president's very clear. It's an old agreement. It needs to be updated. If we can update it, we'll stay in it. If we can't, we'll terminate the agreement. He's been very consistent on that.
What do you suppose happens if we pull out of NAFTA?
Again, I'm not. It would be inappropriate for me to speculate.
Sir, you're the Treasury Secretary of the United States. How can that be inappropriate?
Because again, we're in the middle of negotiations, and I'm not going to, in a public forum, broadcast what the implications are while we're in the middle of negotiations. We're trying to do things that are good for American workers. That's our priority.
And I don't doubt you for a second, sir. I take you at your word. I truly do. But it does seem to me...
Do you want me to tell everybody exactly all our negotiations also? Should I kind of, like, disclose that?
It's your forum. Go ahead, sir. The crowd's with you on that one.
We are trying to create a fair deal. That's our objective.
What does that look like for the Trump administration, a fair deal?
Again, I want to be careful in not broadcasting.
No, come on. You have to. That's a basic question.
Bear with me. No. What I'm going to say, we're in the midst of multi-round negotiations. What I would say is the end result will be more balanced trade, okay, with Mexico on the deficit and... Okay, more protection around intellectual property and other things. But again, it's a very complicated agreement. And again, it's an old agreement. So why wouldn't anybody, you know, want to, on behalf of the American workers, renegotiate the agreement?
I don't think people are opposed to renegotiating, sir. It's the idea of possibly pulling out with no notice.
Okay, well,
actually,
how do you renegotiate an agreement if the other party thinks, if you don't like what they're going to do, you're just going to stick as usual? Why would anybody negotiate? We're gonna negotiate. But if we don't like what you say, we'll just keep it as is. So, you know, even UCLA can't teach people how to do that.
One of the selling points of the tax law
that
you and the president and the Congress passed was that we need to change our tax law to make America competitive in a global economy.
Correct.
Right? And so you cut the corporate tax rate.
Wait a second. The people are hissing. You don't want us to be competitive? I'm just trying to understand this.
We don't want tax cuts for corporations.
Okay.
So the question is, what else does it take to make America competitive other than a tax law? Because it seems to me that was the thing that Republicans in Congress and the White House were selling. So what else is there? Because we have a president and an administration that is at some points eager in being involved in the global economy, and some points it seems not so weak.
How can you say that? Why do you think we're
because
not
the
even?
President has pulled us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He talked about withdrawing from NAFTA. So the question is, no. I mean, take the question at its face. If
yes.
you are a trade minister in Brussels for some European Union country, and you see the president of the United States saying, I'm going to terminate, or negotiations are going fine, what are they supposed to think?
So, again, let me be clear. Our number one priority is the U.S. economy, yep, and American workers and American companies. What is good for the United States, given the size of the U.S. economy, is good for the rest of the world. So when I speak to my European counterparts, they want us to succeed. They want the U.S. economy to succeed. The more the U.S. economy succeeds, the more it grows, the more that we can spend money and buy other things.
Did they not say to you in ministerial set-asides, Stephen, what?
No, they've never said that.
Fair enough.
Actually, what they all were saying is, now we got to cut our tax rates. Boy, you guys did a great job.
Well, it was interesting the other day. Malcolm Turnbull said, I'm in on this trickle-down thing.
He is.
The Australian
Prime Minister. It's not, by the way, we don't refer to this as trickle-down, just to be clear.
Just because you don't call it something, sir, doesn't mean that's not what it is. One more set of questions,
they,
sir.
They like that. You got a lot of applause.
You know, you get your applause, I get
exactly
my applause.
I like this. You know, I think good news is, what I figured out is, if they're clapping, they're not hissing. Or at least you can't hear the hissing.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, I just want to touch briefly on regulations, banking regulations.
Yes.
And then we'll get to some Q&As from the audience.
Terrific.
Brian Moynihan. Let me back up for a minute. One of the things the president has said and his advisors have said is, listen, we need to fix regulation in this country, financial regulation. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law is too strict. We need to loosen it up a little bit. Brian Moynihan, the CEO of B of A, said the other day, Dodd-Frank's fine. What are we doing?
Yeah, you know why? Okay, because the top eight banks control all the assets in the United States, and they don't want anybody else to compete. So what we're trying to do, and by the way, there is bipartisan support for this, and I think this legislation will be passed in the next 3 months, to modify Dodd-Frank so that commercial banks, regional banks, community banks can succeed. Our objective is, we don't want just eight large banks in the United States. So the modifications on Dodd-Frank are all designed to help community banks and regional banks.
Even though community banks are making record profits this past year?
Again, that's because the economy is doing better. But yes, do you want them all to be gobbled up by Brian Moynihan? No, we want to make sure that we have a healthy, broad-based banking system.
So we're going to end it there with my portion of the interview.
Terrific.
Cal's going to climb on, take some questions from the audience.
All right, that was a terrific discussion. I hope we can keep that going. Now, in all of our events, what we do is begin with questions from students. So if there are students in the audience, please raise your hand, wait for a microphone, and we'll bring it to you. So,
did you check IDs that they're really students?
I'm going to trust them to look and appear to be students. Let's start right here. Keep going. Yes.
Thank you so much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words.
Taking time out of your schedule. As a student, seeing nowadays that the political landscape is really divided, I'm just curious, what do you think, individuals like me could do to engage with other people to make for a more, an environment more conducive to discussion?
Well, again, I think that is an incredibly good question. And, you know, the great thing about being at UCLA and places like this is there's a difference of opinions. And there's difference of faculty and courses and everything else. Look, I think it's an obligation of all of ours to be able to listen. And whether you agree or disagree, you should hear people's views. So that's why I came here. I'm interested, happy for you to hear my views. Some people may agree, some people may disagree. But thank you. I think that's an excellent point.
Other questions? Let's try... How about over here?
Thank you so much for coming. I'm a current MBA student here at Anderson. And when I was an undergrad, I worked...
Well, now I don't feel so badly. You're getting hissed as well.
When I was an undergrad, I worked for $6 an hour, and that was a really hard job for me to get. I really appreciated it, and I would have worked for less. So I was surprised in my economics class here at Anderson when I suggested we eliminate the minimum wage. There was so much resistance against it. So I was wondering what you and your administration could do to educate my peers and young people in general about the power of the free market and the opportunity it provides.
No, look, it's a complicated issue when people talk about the minimum wage. And as you know, kind of there's a federal minimum wage and there's a state minimum wage. I mean, you know, what I would say is the most important thing is that people have jobs. They should have good paying jobs. So my view is what we should be focused on is how do we create more good paying jobs? Because we don't want people to have jobs where they can't afford to live and be below the poverty line. One way of doing it is raising the minimum wage. Part of the problem with that is you potentially eliminate a lot of jobs. But, you know, my view is there's pluses and minuses of that. Your view is a view that I think is an interesting viewpoint. But again, to me, the most important issue is how do we create opportunities for companies to have better, higher-paying jobs? And again, that's one of the things we're very focused on.
Do you think, sir, that we'll ever see the Trump administration call for raising the federal minimum wage or perhaps indexing it to inflation?
I haven't had discussions with the president on that, so I can't speculate on that.
What's your viewpoint?
Again, my viewpoint is what we should focus on is creating a marketplace that has higher-paying jobs. That is the most important issue.
How is the tax law going to do that?
Again, I think we've already had this. We went through this series of discussions. So why don't we take a couple of more comments from the audience?
Okay. In the green, right over there.
Okay. You're doing a great job. Thanks for being here, and thank you, Kai, for being here as well. So, you know, this idea of creating new jobs, I think a lot of what we hear from the president and the administration is, you know, kind of going back, you know, making America great again, getting back to a world where largely the economy was made and how it was in the past, maybe when some people thought it was great, formed out of a lot of manufacturing jobs. But a lot of basic economics would say that it just doesn't make sense for those jobs to come back to the U.S., So you're talking about, you know, we want these jobs, or we want more jobs, we want better high-paying jobs for Americans, and I'm sure we can all agree to that. But what does it look like to you a little more specifically? And because I'm having some cognitive dissonance about what I'm learning in school and, you know, macro and microeconomic theory with what I'm hearing that, like, we need to bring coal back, for example, and we need to bring all different kinds of manufacturing back. So I'm just kind of curious what you would like to see the economy look like moving forward to keep America, you know, at the precipice of innovation?
Look, I think that's an excellent question. And when you talk about jobs, I mean, first of all, the services industry is a big competitive advantage for the United States. So whether they're services jobs or whether they're manufacturing jobs, in manufacturing jobs, there's higher value-added manufacturing jobs and potentially jobs that aren't. Technology obviously has a major impact in everything that's being done. So, I mean, look, Apple as an example is committed to building facilities here. You know, one of the things with Apple is you have a whole ecosystem that creates jobs. Some of them could be manufacturing. Some of them could be app developers. I mean, look, Google didn't exist. Facebook didn't exist. There was a time when Microsoft, Windows, I mean, these are all major companies that have been started in the United States that end up obviously creating lots and lots of jobs. So it could be traditional manufacturing. The president is interested in having cars made here. One of the things, the tax deal, we've now seen announcements of a lot of car companies moving assembly into the United States. But there's a whole variety of different jobs, and technology has to be a big part of manufacturing, whether it's 3D printing or other advents, lots of different things. But excellent question.
Okay, a lot of hats over here. Yes, yes, yes.
I'm
not a student. It's okay.
If you believe in economic sanctions, what's your opinion on the president's refusal to enforce the sanctions against Russia enacted by Russia?
So, can I ask you a question? Why don't you think he's enforcing the sanctions? Because first of all, I'm the person in that job. So what sanctions is he not enforcing? And I'm happy to...
So maybe I could clarify the question, right?
Yes, okay. And so, I would also say, because I'm responsible for this, Congress, in one of the overwhelming 98-2 in the Senate, I can't remember the last time anything passed 98-2 in the Senate, just passed the CATSA legislation. I'm actually going to brief Congress tomorrow on this. I've testified. You can go look at my test. We manage these things. So I can tell you, and I... The White House, the press conference on Friday, I said the same thing. You can expect sanctions will be coming in the next 30 days. It's a very complicated process, but I can assure you in Treasury, because we are responsible for this, we are enforcing all the existing sanctions and putting more in place.
Let me pick up on something you just said, sir. Within 30 days, we'll hear Russian sanctions from you?
Yes.
Okay.
More questions. Let's try over here.
Hi, thank you for coming. So you pretty much said that more or less when America succeeds, the world succeeds. But the administration has proposed cutting the budgets for agencies like USAID and organizations like the World Bank. So I'm wondering, do you think America has any role to play in the development of other nations? It doesn't seem like it to me.
So again, let me just say, what I said is, what's good for the United States economy is good for the world. That doesn't mean if the United States succeeds, the world will succeed, because there are all different types of complicated issues right now around the world. I will tell you again, on the World Bank, because again, that's under my area of responsibility, okay, the World Bank, we believe, has plenty of access to capital right now, and we're having discussions, you know, we want it in where, so the answer is, we believe that the World Bank has significant amounts of capital. In regards to other things, you know, kind of, I can tell you there's a lot of, the U.S. provides more aid than almost any other country, and we're having lots of discussions with other countries that should contribute. Some of it is a money issue. There are a lot of issues that money alone can't solve, but money does help a lot in solving a lot of these issues.
Very young student. Yes.
You helped cut taxes for the wealthy, which makes them even richer. The middle class tax cuts are small and last for just 8 years, but the corporate tax cut was permanent. How is that just? When only 1% of our country owns 20% of the wealth, creates a lot of unfairness, especially when so many kids lack basic health care and decent schools. My generation will have to pay off $1.4 trillion in debt, and their tax bill will also lead millions to lose their health insurance. How can you live with this?
Well, since you are so incredibly eloquent, what grade are you in? I'm going to answer the question. Give me a second. I'm complimenting the... Thank you very much. You're very eloquent. And, you know, earlier today, I spoke to a lot of high school students, okay, and they, too, asked very good questions. So we're going to go through. You have a bunch of different things here. Again, what I would say is the primary objective of the tax bill was to create middle-income tax cuts. The reason why that function couldn't be permanent, okay, has to do with a technical issue of what's called budget reconciliation and how it's scored. I'm answering the kid's question. Can you guys wait a second? And the answer is, if you look at our budget, it's in our budget that we want to make the middle income tax cuts permanent, and we intend to go back to Congress, but we need Congress to vote on that to extend it. So that's a big objective of ours. Now, look, you know, people talk about income inequality, and I would go back to a lot of, if you look at kind of a lot of these people in the top 1%, they've created companies. So, you know, Google didn't, again, I'll go back to Google didn't exist, Facebook didn't exist, Amazon didn't exist. These companies create huge amounts of jobs, and a lot of these people have committed to donate a lot of their money. Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation, has done enormous amounts of positive good throughout the world. Okay, so these are complicated issues. I can tell you, as it relates to education, I fundamentally believe that's a very important issue that we need to address. That's a partially a federal issue, partially a state issue, but I assure you, I'm worried about your generation and making sure that you have great opportunities and your generation has great opportunities like people have had in the past.
To the list of things I never thought I'd say, let me follow up on the sixth grader in the back row. And it's a two-part question. The first one's a gimme. Did you guys blow it on the sales pitch on this tax bill because you're getting questions like this from sixth graders or their parents?
Well, I don't know to what extent. I'd like to say he got all the credit. I hope he did the research online. But the answer is I don't think...
Can't trust Wikipedia.
What I would say is right now the tax bill is polling at over 50%. And I would say is I think as people see the economic impact, it's going to be a lot higher. So the polling has gone way up. So, no, we didn't blow it on selling it. This is about creating economic opportunities. And if there are economic opportunities, people will see the effects. And we could debate, as you have before, whether we see these or not. But the results will be clear or won't be clear.
I'm sorry you take questions for debate, sir. I truly am. If you had it to do over again, what would you do different on the tax bill?
I wouldn't do anything different. You know, the fact that this it's been 30 years since we've had major tax reform. I think it was, you know, kind of an incredible team effort with a lot of people across a lot of things. And it was a major effort to get across the finish line. And anytime you do something like this, there's compromises. There's things in here that the president himself would have changed. But the fact is we were able to fix a broken system, make America competitive, and create middle-income tax cuts. And you can hiss all you want, but for the people who are getting these tax cuts, they're not hissing. I'm not getting a tax cut, by the way. I live in California.
Right over here.
I was curious. I'm guessing the tax cuts you alluded to 30 years ago were the Reagan tax cuts.
Yes.
And I was curious, during those tax cuts, through the tax cuts, the U.S. Trade deficit skyrocketed. And considering the Trump administration has put shrinking the trade deficit as one of its forefront priorities, how do you plan to both shrink the trade deficit and cut taxes?
Well, you know, that's a great question. That is a really perceptive, great question, because you're right. If we didn't change any trade issues, and all other things stayed the same, and the economy grew, the trade deficits will grow. So the answer is we have to do both. We have to create kind of economic opportunities. I mean, I can tell you we are in active discussions. You know, President Trump and President Xi from the first time they met, okay? And again, you know, we probably have better relationships with China now than any other president. We have to structurally change things. So we need to make structural changes to trade, or you're correct, kind of it'll go the other direction.
Explain what that means, structural changes to trade.
There are both tariff barriers. So a lot of the places where we have trade issues, it's because U.S. companies can't compete fairly, either because there's tariffs or there's what's called non-tariff barriers into the country. There are legitimate, I mean, countries have distinct advantages. So, I mean, trade is good, okay? And you're not always selling the same thing you're buying. But a lot of places where we have tariff barriers or we have trade deficits, our companies can't compete in selling our goods into their markets.
Let me ask you actually about tariffs and trade barriers that are in the news. The conversation that's being had based on a Commerce Department recommendation about tariffs on aluminum and steel, global tariffs of as much as 24%. Does the Trump administration not worry about reciprocal tariffs going up once we start putting tariffs on goods coming into this country?
Sure. Well, I mean, again, I can tell you the president hasn't made a final decision, but that is the recommendation that came out of the Commerce Department. And I can tell you, you know, kind of we meet every single week. The economic team meets every single week on trade. These are complicated issues, as you've said. It's a chessboard. So, you know, we think about what actions we'll take and what the repercussions are. And it's a multifaceted approach.
Are you meeting with the Chinese economic envoy who's coming this week?
I'm not going to specifically answer that.
Because?
Because, again, I'm not broadcasting private meetings that I'm having, but I will tell you that I am in active discussions with them on economic issues.
Let's try over here. Sorry, in the blue, right here.
Wow, this is an awkward angle.
Just give him the mic. He won't.
Yeah, just step over.
There we go. That's better. Given that the national debt is now well over $20 trillion, does the administration have any plans to look to shrink that in any measurable amount before eventually that bill comes due?
Well, the good news is the bill isn't going to come due for a long period of time. But again, this deficit wasn't created overnight. Okay, it's been created by both Republicans and Democrats, so it's not unique. Okay, a major part of this was the funding of the wars in the Middle East. Okay, so you know this is an issue that the country has, and an issue of whether Republicans are in office or Democrats are in office. This is something that over time is going to need to be dealt with on a bipartisan basis. So as I've said, the number one, you can't cut your way out of this. The number one issue for now is to create economic growth. I will say, you know, and again, we look at, okay, you got to look at the debt relative to GDP. You know, Japan has about twice as much debt relative to GDP as we do. And again, you know, they're focused on their economic growth. But again, these are complicated long-term issues that will need to be dealt with.
So we're a $19 trillion economy, right? The United States, plus or minus?
Yeah.
And our debt is $20 trillion.
We're around 100%.
105%.
And again, whether you look at it private debt or whether you look at it public debt, but it's call it around 100%.
And is that okay?
Again, this is on a relative basis, okay? So, again, the debt wasn't developed overnight.
Absolutely.
The debt needs to be looked at. Debt is okay. So, I mean, you know, again, if you go back to the Clinton administration when the economy was growing, hugely, people were concerned that, like, the debt was going to be paid down to zero, and they didn't know what to do with the money. So some debt is okay. You know, again, going from $10 trillion to $20 trillion over the last 8 years, that's not okay.
What wasn't just the last 8 years, right? I mean, that's been growing for a lot of reasons.
No, I'm giving you 10 to 20.
I understand that. But it was wars in the Middle East started by his predecessor.
I agree.
It was the biggest financial crisis in a generation and a half, right?
I commented that these are issues that have been created by Republicans and Democrats.
Got it.
Yes, in the dark blue or black, correct. Keep your hand up. Yes. Sorry, the woman with put your hand up again. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Hair.
I'm going to cut this off.
Okay. So you said that you're not going to personally have a tax cut, but I'm just curious, how are you personally benefiting from the tax bill?
To come into government, I had to kind of get rid of all my investments and everything else. I can assure you. Well, I don't believe I'm personally benefiting from the tax bill. But again, what I am benefiting from is hopefully the American economy will do better, and that's something hopefully good for everybody in this room.
What keeps you up at night economically? Seriously, not just, and don't give me the, you know, good jobs growing, right? What actually keeps you up?
Well, what I'd say, what worries me, so yeah. In my job, cyber issues are a concern. You know, so as I think of the financial system and everything else, you got a lot of liquidity. I'm not worried about credit. Cyber is a real issue. And again, right now it's something that we're spending a lot of time on to make sure that the financial infrastructure is protected from cyber attacks.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for your time, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. So that's it. That was today's Corner Office podcast. Thanks for listening. If you like it, and of course we hope you do, please consider leaving us a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts. That helps us, and it lets everybody else find us as well, which is, in this podcast game, everything. It's so important. The Corner Office podcast is produced by Bridget Bodner. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Another episode coming for you in a couple of weeks.